iHeart Podcasts.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
So I know you've gotten really into running recently, and I think there's an accessory from Japan you really need to invest in. It's called Tomaton.
Tomaton? That sounds cool. So what's a Tomaton?
Well, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a robot backpack that feeds you tomatoes on the run.
That is not what I expected you to say. That is much less cool than I expected.
Basically, there's this giant cartoony tomato that sits on your head, and it's got this clear tube full of tomatoes that kind of hangs down your spine. And as you run, this robotic arm swoops back to grab a tomato, and then it swoops down in front of you with that juicy fruit and sticks it in your face. And I'm kind of surprised more elite athletes don't use it.
Well, you know, my kids already make fun of me for what I look like when I run, and so I can only imagine this is just going to give them that much more ammunition, which is probably all the more reason I should do it. But I'm curious, why tomatoes of all things? I've never wanted a tomato while I was running.
Well, you haven't before, but now you will. So it was invented by this company called Kagome, which is Japan's premier tomato juice and ketchup manufacturer, apparently. But I am not done talking about Tomaton just yet. So while the original Tomaton is pretty good for 5Ks, you might want to look into the petite Tomaton for marathons. It's lighter, smaller, instead of that robot arm feeder. It's got a trigger and a tube, and you can actually shoot tiny tomatoes in your mouth anytime you want. But it does have a tomato timer that prevents you from eating too many tomatoes too quickly, so you do pace yourself with it. So
that's really impressive. I can't say that I've ever been at risk of feeding myself too many of anything while on a long run, but whatever. That's great. Brilliant.
Yeah, well, it's just the first of 9 facts about robots we're covering for today's show. So let's dive in.
Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Will Pearson, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend Mangesh Hattikader. And sitting behind the soundproof glass, now this guy is working on another movie reboot. Now, Mango, we've seen him work on so many ideas for movie reboots, mm-hmm. and this one is for a feminist reboot for Short Circuit 2. So I think this is going to be a big one. This may be his most brilliant one yet, but that's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil, over there.
That's amazing, Tristan. So I know we both love robots, and I certainly was a Jetsons fan. I had Capsella as a kid, lots of Radio Shack kits, and you know, I loved building weird sort of automated inventions, but there's actually another reason we're doing a show on robots today, right?
That's right. So one of our former guests, Simone Yetch, and you probably know her for her amazing crappy robots that she builds and tests on YouTube. And we are huge fans of mm-hmm. Simone. And if you think about some of the examples of things that she's built, she built the robot that shampoos your hair for you. She's got a hilarious video of this, or the alarm clock that wakes you up just by slapping you in the face, which was also incredibly amusing. But you know, she got some not so great news, though. She feels like she's going to be okay. So she found out that she has a brain tumor, is going to undergo surgery this month, and they're optimistic about the prospects for this. But we really wanted to wish her the very best of luck. So we made this little 9 things in her honor.
That's right. So get well soon, Simone. So back to our love of robots for a second. So people always ask me about my favorite stories and facts from Mental Floss, and there are a handful I always talk about, but my favorite invention has to be this robotic fish that gets other fish to follow it, because it sounds like such a small idea. Like, why do you care that you can create a leader among fish? And the answer is so much more interesting. It's so that, like, if there's an oil spill or a disaster or something devastating, you can actually lead schools of fish away from that disaster. And I just think that's amazing.
It is pretty cool. And I would say it's not as important as the backpack tomato robot, but it feels like it's almost as important as the backpack tomato robot.
Hey, no picking on Tomaton. So what robot factor are you going to start with, Will?
All right, well, here's one that I hadn't really thought about before, and it's what personality your vacuum cleaners should have. And, you know, I know you've probably thought about this. You come up with lots of great questions, but I'd never thought about it, and apparently a lot of scientists hadn't thought about it either. So robots are mostly supposed to be functional, right?
Sure.
But, you know, we're obviously going to have preferences for one robot vacuum cleaner over another if they exhibit these certain behaviors with their sounds. You know, if you think about the sounds they make or the light they put out or the motions they go through, you know, we will have preferences among these.
So can you talk me through a few of these?
Well, let's say you programmed a robot vacuum cleaner to not leave a certain area until it removed a spot. So just imagine it just going over and over this same area in these kind of short, jarring motions. And if it does that, it might come across as obsessive, you know, just going back and forth over that one unimportant spot while there's this whole room it needs to vacuum. So scientists at Delft University in the Netherlands decided to determine what types of personalities people want from their vacuum cleaners. So they rounded up 15 early adopters. These are people who were predisposed to buying robot vacuum cleaners. And then things got a little bit weird. So they hired a bunch of actors to either crawl around or walk around pretending to be vacuum cleaners with different personality traits. Now, at first I thought this was just made up, but this was an actual study. And the only noises they could make were vacuum cleaner noises. So you think whirring and sucking sounds, but they could change patterns and ways that they moved. And they were actually asked to act out these 30 different personality traits for vacuum cleaners. How in the world they could have these 30 different possible traits, I don't know. But, you know, just as examples, they could be bold or calm or talkative or several other things. But it's just crazy to imagine this.
That's funny. It sounds like a terrible improv activity. But
yes, it does.
So what did the scientists actually learn from this?
Well, I mean, most of it was honestly pretty straightforward. Like, you don't want a chatterbox for a vacuum cleaner. And most people also don't want something that feels whimsical. Like, it might make more sense for a vacuum cleaner to move in circles or, you know, maybe these unpredictable patterns once it's mapped out all of the dirt that's in the room. But people actually want to see straight lines and routine. So whether that's actually, you know, the most efficient way to vacuum a room, people perceive that to be the most efficient. But yeah, I actually, honestly, I just like that we had to hire a bunch of Shakespearean trained actors to play the role of like vacuum number three just to figure all of this out.
That's horrible. But I do think it's an interesting idea about how much should we care for and about our robots. And yeah. I was looking into something to that same effect. I found this article from 2013 that, you know, these soldiers who were using bomb disposal robots on battlefields were actually becoming too emotionally attached to them, or at least that was the concern. And the robots weren't particularly cute, like they didn't have like sweet faces or anything, but the soldiers actually started treating them as mascots or pets. And then when they were destroyed, they'd actually have funerals for them. But one of the big questions for robot makers at the time was just how anthropomorphic, like, do you design these instruments? Because, you know, you do want soldiers to care for the equipment and maintain it properly, but you don't want them to care so much and be so gingerly with these things that they'd refuse to put them in harm's way. You know, with too much emotional attachment, you might not send your robot into a space that you think's dangerous, and that's precisely what they're built for.
Yeah, that is pretty interesting. It's not something I'd really thought about before. All right, well, here's a robot that you might have a little bit less sympathy for. So you remember the carnivorous furniture we read about, and this was a while back, but you remember this, right?
Yeah, I feel like it was some European designers or something, and they'd created these porch lamps that were, they were like powered by catching and digesting insects and flies. It was a little gruesome for my taste.
Well, if that was gruesome for you, this is definitely not going to ease your anxieties. And this comes from 2009. There was a Wired article, and they reported that the Department of Defense was funding battlefield robots that could power themselves by collecting organic matter. Now, that organic matter included human corpses.
So, that's just great. We're going to have these flesh-powered battle bots on the fields now.
I mean, it's true. That's exactly what they are. And it's like these scientists have never watched a sci-fi horror movie. And it feels pretty predictable how your war might end in all of this.
Yeah.
And honestly, the worst part is that the project is called, it's called Energetically Autonomous Tactical Robot, or EATER for short.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much I love that fact. I feel like you're just fueling my nightmares. But speaking of human-robot relations, I'd like you to know that we've got work to do on both sides of that equation. And this comes from the story of a little robot called Hitchbot. So Hitchbot was built around 2015, and it was this ultra-cute hitchhiking robot that's only real mission was to see the world and find some good in humanity.
I mean, that's a nice idea. I'm not sure I understand exactly what that means. So how did Hitchbot work?
Well, it was a Canadian creation, and it was solar-powered. It had LED lights. It wore a smile all the time. It had these rain boots. And Hitchbot was about the size of a small child, so it was pretty hard not to love this cute robot. And it was also built to be light enough that you could just pick it up and buckle it into your back seat. The whole idea was it would take photos along the way to document the trip, and it had a few small benefits for the people who picked it up. Like, it came with a cigarette lighter and adapter, so I guess you could charge your phone from it or whatever. But the idea was, like, the creators would put a destination on Hitchbot. So one of the destinations was, like, San Francisco, and they'd tell people to pick them up and then drop them off somewhere you thought someone else might pick them up. Really easy directions, right? So Hitchbot traveled across Canada, he took a trip across Europe, and then he came to the U.S.
That sounds like a setup for something bad. So what happened?
Exactly. So Hitchbot had this great bucket list. He wanted to see, before he got to San Francisco, he wanted to see, like, jazz in New Orleans. He wanted to see the magic of Disney World, various other landmarks. And he started his trip well from Massachusetts. But then 2 weeks later, he was found dismembered in Philadelphia.
Oh, no, that's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's doubly sad when you read his goal on his homepage. It reads, quote, "I hope that my hitchhiking trip will allow me to meet many interesting people, see beautiful places, and learn more about humanity." So, I guess the lesson is you're not supposed to go to Philly to learn about humanity. But
apparently not.
Yeah, poor Hitchbot.
Well, speaking about robots learning, I found this great article in New Scientist, and it was called 8 Hilarious Ways AI Has Outsmarted Us to Get the Job Done. And it's a really fun piece because, you know, we mostly only think that humans and animals can come up with creative solutions and really don't think about robots being able to do that. But these evolutionary algorithms do the same thing. And as the computers are trying to optimize tasks based on the rules you give them, it's pretty funny because they actually end up failing in some of the most ridiculous ways that are great to read about.
So I already like this, but I'm curious about the specifics. So can you give me a couple?
Well, one of the scientists who was interviewed put it this way, quote, "If you close one loophole, the artificial intelligence finds another. To some extent, it feels like you're Wile E. Coyote with the Roadrunner. You set up these wildly complex systems that fail in ways you didn't expect." So, you know, for instance, he asked the computer to create a creature that jumps really high. And the way it measured how high the jump was by how high the creature's foot was off the ground. So instead of trying to train the creature to jump, this wily AI just had this creature do a somersault on the ground and then kick its feet up mid-roll. And so I just imagine this is pretty fun to see.
Pretty smart.
There was also a different simulation where the AI was supposed to create the fastest possible creature. But instead of designing a snake or like some aerodynamic hawk or something like that, it basically spent all its time building this giant creature. And then all they did was push it over because, you know, the velocity of the fall was faster than anything else that it could possibly imagine.
Oh, that's so, really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to even think, like, how they would screw that one up. But honestly, I think my favorite way that AI failed was when it was tasked with limiting a computer's processor usage. So the solution? The robot just turned the computer off.
I love that, actually. So here's a quick fact. It's in a similar vein. I was looking up a cutting-edge story on how far robots had come in 2007. And scientists in NEC in Japan designed this really cute wine bot. And the idea was that you could feed it wine, cheese, or meat, those three things, and it would identify the food for you kind of like a personal sommelier or a metal gastronomist, that's what they called it. And it actually do it without tasting the food too. So you could actually put a wine bottle in front of it and the robot could tell if the wine was authentic and the beverage matched the label outside the bottle.
That would have been good for our old wine frauds episode.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting is that after impressing journalists with the demonstration, this cameraman put his hand up to the robot, and the robot identified the human hand as bacon. So apparently the tech back then still had a little ways to go.
Wow, that would be unfortunate if your hand tasted like or smelled like bacon, rather. I think that would just be torture. But, you know, also, I'm a little curious because cannibals have always said humans taste like chicken, so maybe they're a little off.
I know. My feeling is that, like, maybe bacon's so delicious and cannibals are just trying to protect their interests and keep hipsters away from human meat. I don't know. But what I do know is we've got 2 more robot facts to give you right after this break.
Welcome back to Part-Time Genius. We're talking robots. Or, Mango, I don't know if you knew this, robits, as people used to call them back in the 50s.
What, is that true? That's how it was pronounced?
Yeah, I was actually watching this old documentary, and it was about how scientists were working on robot butlers of the future. And the narrator and even the people on the screen kept calling them robots for some reason.
That's super weird. So I feel like we should bring that back. But what's your last fact about robots?
Well, I know we've talked about humans hijacking animals in the past, and we did this story a while back on how scientists could manipulate cockroaches, you know, to get them to move right or left with these, I guess it was with electrical pulses. And we can actually do the same thing with beetles as well.
Yeah, I'd seen that you can actually put a tiny camera on a beetle now, which is pretty amazing.
That's right. And so to think about how that might be used, you know, the advantage of a swarm of beetles over, say, like, you know, this army of drones is that the beetles are used to flying in bad weather. So they naturally know where to feed themselves, how to rest. And so because of that, you don't have to worry about solar panels not working or a battery that might run out. And, you know, they're obviously super nimble and they're just way more cost effective, too. But the weirdest animal I've read about humans using to their advantage are turtles, which are obviously nothing like beetles. And apparently scientists from Korea have created these parasitic robots that live on top of turtles. And kind of like your tomato robot, it will actually feed the turtle snacks when they move in the right direction.
So I totally get insects. It's creepy that you can turn them into cyborgs and control them. But, you know, they can get anywhere. It makes sense. They can, like, fly and crawl wherever. But why do you want to control a turtle?
Well, I mean, the whole idea is that there are going to be disasters that happen from time to time. So whether it's like floods or spills or earthquakes, and we just can't get to these spots very fast. But if you hijack a turtle population in the area, or any animal really, and then you survey the land by using them as your rover, it actually becomes really beneficial. And unlike the bugs, which you have to outfit with cameras, if you're just dropping these parasite robots on land and they each find a turtle to ride, it ends up being much more efficient.
That's pretty crazy. Okay, so here's my last robot fact. In 2008, a postdoc fellow at Hokkaido University wanted to figure out if robot comedians can make people laugh. So he had people read a bunch of text message jokes, and then he had robots deliver those same jokes.
So what happened? Were the robots actually funny?
Yeah, I mean, they were marginally funnier. On a scale of 1 to 5, the text jokes scored a 2.3, while the average robot comedian landed a 2.8.
Oh, that's not bad. I mean, that's half a point more. It's pretty good, actually.
Yeah, but then he evolved the robots to make them even funnier by adding fart noises. So,
right, of course.
The combination of robots making jokes and fart noises drove the numbers even higher. And the moral was pretty easy to figure out. Like, robot comedians can be funny, but gassy robot comedians are even funnier.
That's some pretty good science, you know? I feel like we had some good facts here. But I feel like what you just closed with was some pretty solid science. And the fact that even robots can figure out that fart noises are funny. I feel like I'm going to have to give you the trophy today, Mango.
Thank you so much, Will.
And thank you guys for listening. We'll be back with a full-length episode tomorrow.